You're listening to the All Day Rock Off podcast, episode number 102. Welcome to the All Day Rock Off podcast, episode number 102. This is your host, Brian, and I wanted to thank you so much for tuning in. The All Day Rock Off podcast focuses on the GRT and rucking community, and includes interviews, motivation, and advice to keep you informed and get you ready for your next event. In this episode, I am joined by James Vreeland, who you might remember from episode 66, or from completing both selection and team assessment. Back in episode 66, James joined to talk about passing selection. Here we are in episode 102, and he's back to talk about team assessment. In this interview, we talk about the differences between GORUCK selection and team assessment. We talk about training for team assessment, his experiences there, and a lot about that event. It's really fun having him on because we keep bringing it back to the differences between GORUCK selection and team assessment. I know leading up until team assessment, a lot of people thought that it was essentially going to be team selection, and James does a really good job addressing that. Before we get into the interview, I want to give a big shout out and thank you to my buddy Dan, who was the first Patreon supporter. Dan, I really, really appreciate that. And I just want to say thank you. Your support of the show that way truly means a lot. If you're listening and you're curious what Patreon or any of that stuff is, you can check out alldayrockoff.com. There's info there, or you can go to patreon.com/alldayrockoff or check out the show notes. Thank you again, Dan. And with all that said, here is the awesome interview with James Vreeland. Today, I'm talking with James Vreeland. I'm really excited to have him back on the podcast. This is his second time on. You might recall his first time he talked about him completing GORUCK selection. This time, we're talking about GORUCK team assessment, which he took part in and finished. Really excited to have you back. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. It's about a week and change after the event, and all the scabs are healing, and I'm not walking funny, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Glad to hear it. How has the recovery process been compared to selection?
Honestly, it wasn't too bad. If you saw the live footage, I got a little bit of, Ohio rash. They had us going through this drainage culvert, and we had, something in there. I mean, Jason thinks it was grass allergy. I think it was something else funky, but I got some pretty nasty contact dermatitis, and both of my arms got real gross for a bit. But in terms of like everything else, not bad. And I'm sure we'll kind of dive into it a little bit as we talk through the differences between, you know, selection and assessment. But for whatever reason, the sort of like the healing process was super quick for assessment. I'm still tired. Like whenever I try to, you know, like go for a hard run, it turns into a jog real quick. But the getting from like, you know, back to 85% fine, that happened a couple days. I went climbing, you know, maybe 3-4 days after we got back from the event.
That's impressive. And I like that, what do you say, grass allergy? That's the safe way to call it. Was probably, I saw that water. That was disgusting water.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't smell like kerosene, but you know, it didn't feel stellar in there. That might have been a little bit of like ad-libbing on Cadre's part to not have maybe checked that area completely for stuff. We found some wire, some glass, some good living was hiding in that little ditch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was no way you could see the bottom of it.
Nah, it was dark and miserable.
So team assessment, GORUCK announced it during selection of last year, and they kept it really under wraps. I mean, when they announced it, I messaged a couple cadre. I think Jason was on, I had Cadreon after selection, and no one would say anything about team assessment. How quickly between when the announcement did you sign up for it?
Real quickly, actually. At the last selection, the guy who I ended up partnering with for this event, he stroked out on a run. So he was feeling pretty nasty about being trained up so hard for that event, really being over before it even started for him. So kind of as a hey man, you're already in damn good shape. Let's figure out the right way for you to get like a win under your belt to kind of make this little oopsie go away. Cause he was in phenomenal shape at the last election. He just, you know, you saw the coverage of that. It was 102 heat index and people were dropping like flies. And unfortunately he was one of them. So it really, as soon as they put her up there, I talked to him really briefly and said, does this seem like the type of thing that you want to tackle? He said, yeah. And we signed up pretty, I think we were actually like, I think I was the first sign up and he was shortly after that.
That's a really good idea. I mean, I saw that live coverage and I mean, he doesn't care what shape you're in. It will attack you and get to you. So, what a good way to turn a super negative experience, you know, training up for and traveling to this huge event that you've been prepping for into, you know, a way to work towards something else that's still hard. And, you know, it worked out for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Couldn't ask for a better teammate with, Mr. John Grobel.
So training up for this event versus, training for selection, did you use, you know, some of the things that you had learned while you're training for selection when you're training for this, or did you attack it differently? Kind of what was your team members or your teammates' approach?
Yeah, so the little bits that we could sort of glean about what the event was going to be sort of made it seem like it wasn't going to be like a cadre smoke show. It wasn't going to be super high intensity. It was going to be a series of very unpleasant tasks you had to get through, you know, in a certain time cut to stay ahead of like that cutoff gate. And that's really all we really knew. And if you kind of step back from that and say they wanted it to be a, you know, a graded event as opposed to a, you know, almost like the last man standing that selection has turned into. If you think about like what they could actually put at you in a graded event, it has to be kind of fixed work capacity things. It may be horrible. They may be unreasonable time limits. But it seemed like they would have to do the type of things where they would say, you know, here's a log. It's got to go 6 miles. You have 2 hours. Or here's 10 sandbags. Get them around the cornfield loop, however you see fit, whether you do one loop or five loops, they just have to all go around. So we sort of took the little tiny bits that we knew and kind of extrapolated that it was going to be a, you know, digging deep for a long period of time and moving a lot of heavy stuff. And thankfully that's more or less where it turned out to be. I was expecting a little bit more kind of slick mileage. Cause if you look at sort of what like Best Ranger and some of these other things that are kind of in the same world, if you try to compare, you know, assessment to like a Hell Week and something like Best Ranger, which is a, how can you put two people together to get a task done? I was kind of expecting there to be like a long duration ruck, like a Star Course type of thing. But, you know, obviously it turned out to be a ton of laps around that field in Jason's backyard. So some points we guessed right, and some points we, you know, kind of had to take that gamble and not to not get into. In terms of sort of what I took from selection, I definitely, when I went through selection, there was a lot less known about it. So I trained up the best I could. But there were things I didn't do well enough. Like I didn't do enough just straight shoulder work. When I was training for selection, I did much more, you know, just PT and body weight and weighted PT. So this time around, I got myself a nice Planet Fitness membership just so I could hop on their shoulder isolation machines. And after I got done with my runs, because it's like a 2 mile run to the place, I'd run up there, do, you know, sort of shoulder and chest work, and then run home and call that a good afternoon for one of my training sessions. But by and large, it was not dissimilar from how I trained for selection, just a little bit less intensity because I say I don't have it in me to train up for selection again. I think it's a nightmare.
Yeah, everyone I've talked to who has finished selection has said it's been a nightmare. I think that's a general consensus.
Yeah. And the wife wouldn't have allowed me to dedicate as much time as I did. Like the first time I went through, you know, I was doing 10 or 12 training sessions a week every 6 months. I couldn't dedicate that much time to it. So I sort of figured out how much time I could give to assessment and did the best I could. And sort of what seemed to be the best use of time was getting my running in shape and putting on as much just, you know, mass as possible, because I was, when I signed up, I was like 165, 170 and global was 225. And that's a big difference in weight between the two of us. And with the idea that it's a team race, we were kind of expecting there would be some level of move your buddy, whether it's like a buddy carry, buddy drag, that type of thing. So we wanted to be not one for one, but, you know, I would put on 20 pounds, he would shave 20 pounds, and we would be comparable sized humans as opposed to the, you know, what was it, 60 or nearly 60 pound difference that we had when we started.
I can definitely see why you would shoot for something like that. I mean, especially because it's a team event. So you mentioned the hours that went into training for selection. You had to pour a ton of hours in for team assessment. How many hours did you train between when you signed up, which was, you know, back at selection time to the event?
Yeah. So let's call it like about 6 months of like probably good, hard, dedicated training for it. John and I go to the same gym, so we see each other and we train a couple times a week anyway. We upped that a little bit. So I'd say I was 4 or 5 days a week, I was doing 2 or 2.5 hours of training. And then I had usually took like a Sunday rest day, which I would do climbing or a little bit of running. And then 2 other days a week, I'd be in there for 1.5, 2 hours. So math on the fly, you know, call it probably 20 hours a week of some form of training, give or take. And I'd say that the majority of that was not with a barbell. So it was either rucking or running or sandbags or PT with a vest, things like that.
Yeah. And it seemed like that definitely paid off. How many miles about, give or take, did you ruck in preparation for this?
I didn't actually ruck that many. My, for better or for worse, I can stride it out like a champ on a pretty short notice. I have big, long legs. So I spent a lot more time on the running aspect because, like, as I was putting on mass, I was getting slower, which kind of sucked. So I was a pretty adequate runner when I was at 165, 170. When I hit, you know, like 190, which I think was my heavy weight before the event, I was notably slower. So I spent a lot more time just figuring out how to move that extra 20-ish pounds of me around. The rucking stuff, I teach a class in my gym, so I'm not, you know, I ruck every week regardless. Dedicated rucking, 10, 15 miles a week would be probably average. But then on top of that, another 15 to 20 of running.
So no small amount. I mean, that adds up over the course of 6 months.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't just like say like, oh yeah, I used to be able to bang out a good 12 miler. It'll be fine on game day. You have to kind of stoke that fire a little bit. But I, in that whole kind of balance of where can I put time, I knew that the benefit I would get from a little bit of extra running would outweigh the benefit I would get from a little bit of extra rucking. I knew that when push comes to shove, I can fake that aspect a little bit. And I had a good dry run of that because we, John and myself and a bunch of the Detroit folks, we all did a race down in Arizona in January that ended up being moderate to heavy rucking through the desert. And I think my team and John's team, we ended up doing 60, 65 miles, somewhere in that range. We handled that like a champ. So I knew there was nothing wrong with my rucking and I could focus on other stuff.
Perfect. And that's something that's, you know, it's always good to know about your body, what you need to do to improve and where you can, you know, dedicate a little bit less time. That's something that you really only learn training for bigger events like this, because then you see where you fall short. Like you said, that you noticed when you trained for selection, you had to work more on your shoulders. So when you sign up for team assessment, you got that gym membership and hit that harder than you might have, you know, done otherwise.
Yeah, I think I went into this event with pretty open eyes in terms of where I'm not stellar at things. Like I didn't lift in high school, so I know that like my bench and my shoulders is not that of somebody who's been like a gym rat for their whole life. This is still comparably new to me in the whole scheme of things. And I've only been doing these races for, I don't know, eight or nine years.
And that's funny because that seems like a long time, but in the grand scheme of things, it really isn't.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to like somebody who, you know, or even if you like in the CrossFit world, if you find somebody who gets into it and they've come from like a gymnastics or, you know, cheerleading background, they have just weird stabilizers and they have like a body kind of awareness that years and years and years of that drill goes such a long way. Like they still have to work for everything, but the fact that from a very early age they've, you know, worked on shoulder stabilization, or they have a gymnastic skill set that is not there in the average person, it goes such a long way for giving them a good leg up for doing the hard work that, you know, that they have to do to move ahead.
Absolutely. So is there anything that you found that you did training either alone or with your partner that really helped out during team assessment? Things that, you know, when you're doing team assessment, you're thinking, man, I'm glad I did X, Y, and Z because this makes this a little bit easier.
Yeah, I think the time under heavy loads, so not even like rucking, but the, you know, we would routinely do a couple mile sandbag carries with, you know, 60, 80 pound sandbags. And that's that type of, man, this is awful. Well, I guess it's going to be awful for another full lap now. But just that awareness of it's really unpleasant now, but I know that sort of shut off panic breathing you get when you have like a really heavy weight on your back, I know that's not going to get a whole lot worse for me. Like if I don't go any faster, it's going to keep feeling bad, but it's going to keep feeling this bad. I'm already feeling this bad, so I'm aware of it and I'm used to it. It's not going to get worse, so there's no reason to put the sandbag down because I can just, you know, suck it up and deal with exactly how bad it feels right now.
Yeah. And that's something you can only learn, like you said, grabbing a heavy sandbag and taking it out for miles.
Yeah, there's a lot of things like, surprise, surprise, you know, the feeling of a crushing weight is not like an ingrained kind of behavior that a lot of people experience. Like it's, until you felt that, you know, like what it actually feels like when your grip fails on you, like when you're carrying something and it just falls out of your hands, not because you dropped it, but because just gravity says, nope, you're done carrying that now. And until you've, you know, sort of done things to failure a bunch of times, it's going to be a new experience. And if that new experience happens in the middle of a race, you have to not only deal with it, you have to adapt to it then. And if you've already felt that stuff and you've already kind of, you know, if you've already done the work to like dig that well previously, you can tap into it at race day and not have to worry about learning on the fly.
Yeah, you really don't want to be learning anything on the fly at GoWork events, especially at team assessment. And that kind of hearing you say that brings me back to, I think it was podcast episode 99, where Adam was on and talked about being a type 1 diabetic at GoWork events. During training, he would figure out how it felt. And so he knew when he would need certain things. And so when he was at the event, he's like, oh, this is how I feel. You know, it's not a new experience during the event because you never want new things at event time when you're trying to perform.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're solving against like a known problem, like, oh yeah, my feet always feel this bad. And you know, once I break 20, 30 miles, there's nothing wrong with them. They just hurt real bad. Then you can say, okay, yeah, I guess my feet hurt. I don't have to worry about them. It's just my feet hurting, you know, or I'm not able to really, I can't brain right now. I've been up for 30 hours. All I can do is be robotic. I don't have to worry about, oh man, can I still be a functioning human right now? I just have to put one foot in front of the other. If you know, like, no, oh man, on that second night from, you know, hour 30 to 34 or whatever it is, you're going to be a zombie and that's okay. You just have to, you know, kind of go into shuffle mode for that duration. You'll be fine when the sun pops back up. That's like knowing that about yourself is great. It doesn't make it easier, but it helps you plan for the stuff that you know is going to happen. There's so many unknowns in these events. Any little thing you can do to sort of not game it, but to sort of stack the deck a bit in your favor is going to pay dividends down the road.
And so you knew that about yourself because you completed selection. So, I mean, we've got a whole conversation about you in the second night at the event, you know, being a zombie, walking through on the long walk. Did your teammate, had they been up into that 30, 36 hour mark before? Do you recommend people spend, you know, one training regiment doing that? Or is that something that is maybe okay to learn during the event?
I mean, that's going to be kind of up to you. Like, so John has done at least one event in that kind of range. We both did. It's called TPK. It's put on by Brandon and Odette. They're lovely folks who do kind of a more traditional adventure race type of thing. And so we had both been into a 30 to 36 hour kind of race in there. So I knew that John gets a little poopy on that second night. And I tend to get kind of slappy, and that's okay now. A discussion that we had quite often was like, hey man, I know everything sucks and you just want to kind of shuffle there, but you can be sad and you can feel bad for yourself. But you have to be sad that way at my pace. And he kind of grumbled about it, and then we did it and it was fine. And we got through that because we knew that I was going to be the annoying chipper person for a couple hours and then bonk a little bit later. And for that little duration, all he had to do was follow my strobe light as close as possible. And eventually the sun would come up and he'd be fine again. But I guess to answer your other question of like, should people go into that kind of weird area? I think so. I mean, if for no other reason, then there are some really cool races that take a long time. Like when we first started, like when you and I first started chatting about this, I was sort of sketching out the what have I done that's been over 24 hours, just like the what are my long duration races. And there's a lot of fun ones like all across the board. And they all take very different skill sets, but they all sort of require you to be okay functioning at some sort of diminished capacity. And if you go into those races alone and without a plan for how you're going to behave once the wheels start coming off, I mean, that's just one more thing you have to worry about day of. And it's not that hard to skip a night of sleep and then go through a nasty training. I mean, do it on a weekend so you don't necessarily drive anywhere, but make it the type of thing that you can, you know, take yourself out of that sleep comfort zone. And how does your body honestly feel when you are, you know, when you don't want to move? Because like the first thing that happens that second night is like you lose all motivation. So when you don't want to do anything and you just want to sit down, you just want to pout for a minute, how do you personally figure out what is the best way to, you know, take all of your feelings, put them back into your backpack and keep walking?
I like that analogy. Just grab your feelings and shove them in the ruck and keep going.
Yeah.
Probably a little easier said than done.
I mean, the other option is quit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, you can either do the damn thing that you signed up for and you went into this event knowing more or less what you were going to get, whether it's this or death race or an ultra or like whatever it is. Like, there aren't that many races where you walk in like, I have literally no idea what's going to happen. Even this one, like we didn't know exactly what's going to happen, but we knew more or less it was going to be roughly 2 days of a whole bunch of really unpleasant, grueling stuff in, you know, in Ohio. And because it's in Ohio, you know, it's going to be in Jason's backyard. So if it's in Jason's backyard, you know, there's that stupid mile loop in the river. So you know, at least you're going to be roughly in this area doing miserable nonsense for about 2 days. And the company has sandbags, so we'll probably be using sandbags. Like if you sign up for an event and you can't extrapolate at least that much, I recommend doing more research. Like that's, none of that was a given, but all of that was kind of easily deciphered, that was sort of going to be the structure of this thing.
Yeah, that's all stuff that you can probably take away from, you know, the wording they use in the website, the minor comments they've made about the event, the location, and it all makes sense. So if you got to pull the info out and use anything you can to your advantage, especially at an event like this.
Yep, for sure. And even like to the extent of because they called it assessment and there's an actual military thing called assessment, you can kind of look and sort of figure out the sort of vibe they're going for, it being more of a, how do you and your team member work together? How do you, you know, it's a always graded, how do you perform under stress? How do you adapt to unknown, whatever? So it's a little bit more of that than a, can you do enough pushups fast enough at hour 20 after I've already, you know, had you in and out of the river? It's kind of knew it was going to be, what is your like fast twitch capacity over time? It was going to be more of a, how bad do you want to be here? And are you willing to sort of do the things that need to be done to make that happen?
Got it. And I think watching the live coverage, you could really see that, especially if you watch both the selection live coverage and the team assessment live coverage, the difference there.
Yeah, for sure.
So moving into the event, what team number were you?
Roster one and roster two on team one. So,
and how did you get team number one?
We signed up first. Also, I think Jason wanted to paint a bullseye on me.
Yeah, I thought that was that's pretty nice, since you had finished selection, that you were, you know, team one, and everyone knows what they say about team one, roster one, and
yeah, guaranteed to finish. That's what they say.
Yep, there's no better way to guarantee success than be number one.
Yeah. So if anybody doesn't know, like it, in general, in most military camps, like whether it's true or not, the instructors will always like let roster number one know, like, man, you're not going to finish. Like number one, nobody's ever finished with roster number one. So the giving that to us was a kindness, I think, on Jason's part, or on, I think actually Ragnar gave it to us, but
maybe a little endearing.
Sure, I'll take it.
So when you completed selection, that was during the kind of selection roadshow, right? Where they were driving it around the country, and it wasn't a super huge selection class like what you see, you know, in 2019, 2018. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, the more recent years actually tend to be a little bit smaller. I mean, not smaller than mine, but smaller. But like when they first moved it from being a monthly event, because for a while there was a selection event almost every month. There was the 000, the screener down in Jax or somewhere, Alexandria, you know, south. And that one had a handpicked class, and it was a big class, and they were working a lot of the kinks. And then they took like a month or two off, and they started doing, you know, the monthly events, kind of like how you almost see like some of the more kind of capstone-y heavies now, like with that frequency. So mine was class 05. In Chicago, so it was like Schaumburg area, and it was April, so it was cold. But the since then they moved, obviously, after I think class maybe 13 or so, they moved it to the annual, 13 or 14, somewhere in that range. They clicked it over to being a more sort of once a year or twice a year event, and that's when you started seeing it rotating between Jax and Bellbrook and then Bozeman for at least one cycle.
And when team assessment started, I know I was, you know, a little surprised at the number of teams that showed up, because I'd been, you know, used to seeing the live coverage for selection where we've, you know, got a lot of people there. But for you, having done selection in kind of a smaller selection class, I mean, maybe you weren't as startled when, I mean, how many teams was it that showed up?
There were 16 teams that showed up. So the total roster count was a little smaller than I expected, to be honest. So there were 43 on the roster. So make assume that at least somebody, you know, had a thing pop up. So call it 40 legitimate people on the roster. So that's 20 teams. I expected around 15 teams to show up, like, you know, around a quarter to not even show, and then around five to not pass PT. So I was generally expecting the event to start with 8 or 10 teams ready to go into the actual evolution, because that's been kind of the headcount that you've seen in the more recent selection classes, where 70 will show up and 40 will pass most of the PT, and then the welcome party will knock it down from that to 15. Like that's sort of the percentage breakdown that we've been seeing. So for it to start, I mean, really the event in my mind doesn't start until the PT test is over, because that's sort of like the graded beginning. If you don't pass those, I mean, good on you for showing up and doing your damnedest, but you know, it's the actual yes, medical has happened, and yes, gear check has happened, and yes, we've done all the PT, we are now ready to begin the unknown aspect of it. So that to be just two teams, that was surprising. And for it to be Jones, that made my heart sink, because that man is a known monster.
Yeah, I was a little shocked too that it was only, you know, two teams that made it through the opening bit with the shakeout, the what's it, push-ups, sit-ups, run and ruck. The shakeout was interesting to watch live. How many times did your team have to go through that shakeout?
I want to say we did it on the first try, to be honest.
I think you did.
It was either the first, we might have needed the second one, but I think we got it on the first try. Because it's all about like listening to cadre and seeing what they wanted. Like, we were never told dump all your crap on the ground. We were told, show me this element. So both John and I just popped our bags open at our feet, pulled out that one element. As soon as that element was, you know, done with, we gently put it away. Like, we didn't just toss it on the ground for further inspection. If, you know, if they were, it looked like they were going through all the dry bag stuff. So I pulled my whole dry bag out, opened it up. I had all my stuff for the dry bag. Once we showed it, it all went back in the dry bag. So when it came time to pack stuff up, I only had like 4 or 5 discrete elements to get back into my bag and locked it up in time. We also both ran GR2s, which give you a little bit of extra space. Like, you could have, obviously you could have squoze all that stuff into a GR1, but I'm, you know, a reasonably tall dude. So I could pull off having that extra ruck space. And I'm happy I did, because as things got grosser and things got harder to pack, it was nice not having to, you know, basically bust zippers to get stuff in and out. You can actually have that little bit of extra room to have an area for just for clothing, an area for just for gear in there.
Right. And I mean, it's like the rules with packing, right? If you're leaving on a trip and everything fits perfectly and there's no extra room, then you're going to be a little screwed coming home.
Yeah, for sure. I'm super happy that we got to leave our MREs in our food bag, because those suckers are big and bulky. And the packing list had like sealed MREs. So you couldn't even bust them open and field strip them and take all the air and nonsense out. So you had, you know, something the size of, between the two of them, you had like basically a 2-liter bottle's worth of space taken up by two MREs if you weren't careful. And that adds up quick, because those things don't compress and don't pack around stuff very well.
Sure does. And so it's interesting going back, one thing you said about, you know, the shakeout, because the camera never really focused on your group. I just saw your group finish and move off. And I think, like you said, it was after that first time, but there are a couple groups that had to, I mean, they spent minutes there just dumping gear, putting everything back in. And so based on what you said, it sounds like, you know, taking a couple breaths and having a cool head and listening to what the cadre is saying really was crucial for your team in making it so you only had to do it once and you didn't have to go through dumping it dozens of times.
Yeah. And also, like, it's in general, when you look at sort of like how selection has started, and that's kind of the only thing we could draw a corollary to, you tend to have your shakeout, and then you have a little bit of downtime when PT happens. And then you get a little bit of time to refit for the run. And then when you finish the run, you have a little bit of time to refit for the ruck. And then after the ruck, however much time you have left, that's sort of your rest time and your downtime. So when cadre is like yelling at you, like, get your crap, get it in your bag, don't worry about like putting it back in your bag in the right spot. Just get it into your bag. As long as your dry bag is in there, and you can, you know, if you have to break it up across rounds, like, spend one entire round just shoving all of your clothing into your dry bag and make that go away. Like, don't worry about, you know, breaking things back into the right pockets. Just get all of your stuff into your bag as fast as possible. It's a long event. You'll be in and out of that ruck many, many times. If you have a rough idea of where stuff can go, you can always improve your situation along the way. So if you don't get that punch in the face of cadre really kind of like riding you because you can't pack your bag, get all your stuff in the bag now, then the very next time you go in there to refill your water bladder, then you realize, okay, cool, my runners are in the wrong spot. I'll put them in the right spot now. Or my product's got too much air. I'll take that 15, 20 seconds to fix it now. And just get off of the X. Like, when you're out there in front of cadre and they're, you know, counting down for you packing your bag, they're watching you right there in that particular second. So do everything you can to get off of that little field of view. And there's tons of places in these events, even selection, there's little bits of downtime here and there in selection where you can fix your gear. Like you can ground your ruck for a second and you can move runners or you can fish your gloves out or whatever it is. There's some place to take 15, 20 seconds to improve your situation during gear shakeout is not that time.
And I saw that and I was kind of, I don't know, chuckling myself a little bit because as soon as you guys were off to the side, I mean, within a couple minutes, I think you were both digging through your ruck and just kind of improving your situation with no category around yelling at you while everyone else is still like dumping and repacking.
Yep. Yeah. And that's part of the pace to be a winner, but that's also just, if the task at hand is pack your ruck and go way over there until these knuckleheads are done packing their ruck, I'm going to pack my ruck in the worst, fastest way possible so I'm not one of those knuckleheads. And then everything else, like cadre have much bigger fish to fry than am I doing what I'm exactly supposed to be doing off to the side, because that is time to refit. Like if I had a rock in my shoe, I could pop it and fix it then. Like whatever it is, like get out of their little lane of fire, whatever you want to call it, and go fix your stuff elsewhere. So just do whatever it takes to get out of their immediate area of focus and you're going to be in a much happier situation.
And they seem like throughout the entire event that was kind of the process. It was, you know, it pays to be a winner. The team that wins, it gets to sit, gets to either refuel a little bit, get the, you know, drink, fix their feet, fix their ruck, kind of improve their situation and position while the other team's finishing up.
Yeah. And that was usually us, unfortunately. And I think that like in this case, it was a little bit of a nightmare for us because there were only two teams. Because it wasn't the type of thing where like the top three teams get a rest break, everybody else gets smoked. It was last place is getting really no rest time. They're getting right back into it. When there's only two teams, that turns what we kind of expected to be a, you know, roughly 40 to 44 hour staged event with a little bit of a race at the end. It turned into a 48 hour race. So it just, the lack of people that showed up made it impossible to have really any place to seek cover unless you were that first team. And unfortunately, the first couple elements, they didn't favor us so much. Like every time that there was like a heavy thing, we did stellar. Anytime that there was a like gymnastic or kind of sprinty thing, you know, Durkin and Jones, they're just better athletes in that capacity. So they got ahead of us. And once they got ahead of us, like, man, they didn't have to work as hard to maintain that lead. They still put out effort the whole time, but they were in a situation where for us to catch them, John and I had to kind of overcome the fact that we didn't have a rest break. We had to sprint on an entire element, which puts them to a bad spot where they, because they had done their work early on, they had a little bit of downtime. They were a little more rested. They were a little more ready to go in and hit an evolution at 90% effectiveness, and that was still better than our fatigued 100% effectiveness. So going forward, I think in future ones, I really hope there are more teams that show up, because I think that'll be a pretty interesting telling of how to really game these things. Just because there weren't enough people at this one to really see how they'll be more traditionally run. Because I know Jason wants to get, you know, they're doing some stuff to make it seem like they want a much higher headcount of attendance in future ones. So hopefully that'll give a little more, you know, not leniency is the wrong term, but a little more room in the field for people to differentiate to play the game of how hard do I want to work right now to get more of a rest break versus can I just be sort of middle of the field on this particular evolution. Don't be last, but don't really smoke myself going to that top place, because I'd rather save a little bit in the tank for work later. And really that sort of race, we'll have to wait and see how the future ones go, because that's not what we experienced. We just got to the point where we would finish an evolution, get 2-3 minutes to refit on water, then we were right back out there. So we caught our breath, but never had a chance to like recuperate until we started getting some proper downtime rest breaks.
That's such a tough spot to be in, because it's like you said, so true. The team, as long as you can just finish those first one or two in first, then you get that extra time to relax, you get to, you know, recover, and you know, your 100% at a fatigued rate was, you know, still about their, would you say 80 to 90% at their recovered rate. And you can just keep stretching that lead and stretching that lead and getting more time to, to fix yourself.
Yep. And I think Cadre also saw that because it, again, because this was the first one of its going, they sort of saw what had to be done to play around with it. And I want to be very clear. Like, I'm taking nothing away from Jones and Dirk, and they kicked us into the ground. They got out early and they never stopped. But the pace be a winner aspect, I think the Cadre planned out would have been stellar with a team of, even if there's like five or six people, just so you could kind of cycle, or you could at least like cycle who was in that kind of the last place. It's just when there's only two and there's a winner and a loser, it converts it from being a long grinder into being a series of sprints. And they took advantage of that, and good on them.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely taking, you know, nothing away from them. That's the name of the game with team assessment, apparently. You know, is it pays to be a winner. And unfortunately for you and your team, they won the first, you know, they won a bit and then just kept stretching the lead. So that's the, that's how the game works.
Indeed.
So going through team assessment, I mean, it's a team event. You're there with a partner. And so when you're doing selection, your why might be away from you. It might be at a, you know, it might be at home. It might be the reason why you're doing an event might not be standing right next to you. But for team assessment, did you find that, you know, helpful being on a team and knowing that you have to gut it out and stick it through so that your teammate can succeed as well?
It was definitely a little bit of a different why. Like I there was definitely a lot of, in this one, the ability to know, like, man, if I quit now, I'm quitting for two. To sort of keep you in there and driven. I think that finding your why on selection is a little different because you have to sort of pull it out of yourself. And there's nobody there who's going to give you, like, even like that back, like, all right, man, yep, sucks. Do you want me to carry the sandbag for a hot second? We'll, you know, take a quick breather, but let's do it on the run. But it's, you know, it's a different way of motivating. Like if you're the type of person who needs external motivation, like needs to be a part of a team to finish stuff, assessment's great for you because you and your team, if you have good rapport, you can feed off each other very, very well. If you're the sort of person who needs a little bit of external motivation, so you need that, you know, your buddy saying like, man, this sucks. It'll be great to talk about how bad this sucks over beers later. If you're that type of person who feeds off of that, selection is going to be a very hard road for you to walk because you constantly have to not only self-motivate, but self-justify. Like in the middle of selection, anything else on earth seems like a better idea than whatever nonsense you're doing. Like there's no part of it that seems like you should logically be making that decision to be right there, you know, in that situation, doing that thing right now. Like you're either cold or you're hot or you're hungry or you're chafed or you're all of those things. And unless you have a really, really good reason and a really, really powerful driver as to why your reason supersedes all of the discomfort you're in or how tired you are or how much you'd rather not be getting yelled at by Cadre or, you know, you've already done 24 hours, why am I still doing this? I've gone so much further than anybody else has in this race. Unless at that point you still have a like, right, but I still have to finish doing the thing I'm doing right now so I can do the next horrible thing they're going to make me do, so I can do the next horrible thing so I can be that much closer to the end. Unless you can, you know, do that for yourself, assessment and selection are fundamentally different beasts. And selection is a cruel mistress like that because it's super easy for you to get a little bit of rest at that 24-hour mark, a little bit of chow, and for all of your good reasons to just evaporate.
And like you mentioned, when we were talking kind of closer to the beginning about the 30 to 34-hour mark where, you know, you realize what you're going to be and how your teammate's going to be, and you guys have this game plan going in. It's like, you know, that he's going to be a little poopy and you're going to be a little chipper, and you can have this way to bring each other up. When you're doing, you know, selection, all you have is yourself, so you don't have someone there. And like the cadre there aren't going to motivate you to, they're going to motivate you to quit. They're going to say, we've got some more food if you want it. Come eat back at the house. So,
you know what's great right now? The fire. It's warm. We're telling great stories. Beer's cold.
You're missing out.
You can even go into the house and use the shower. We'll talk to the folks. We'll clear it. There's a nice comfy bed up there. Man, did you see those space blankets we had? Those things look awesome. You sure you keep one of you in barrel rolls in this swamp? All right. Roll left.
So, I mean, selection, it has a lot of that, right? And we see it on the live feed. I mean, I'm sure you hear it when you're out there. Just a lot of, you know, taunting-ish, a lot of, I'm telling you, you're not, you know, just quit now. You're never going to finish. There's too much weight here. You're never going to move it quick enough. You're never going to, you know, it's a lot of you're never trying to get you to quit on yourself, as opposed mm-hmm. to being like, yeah, you've got this, you know, just carry the sandbags.
Yeah, but cadre never lie to you at this election. They will tell you like ugly truths, like, candidate, you are terrible at this. That's different than like, I'm going to drop you if you don't go faster. Like they just tell you really unpleasant truths because you probably are terrible at it and you probably aren't moving it fast enough. But that doesn't mean you should stop. It doesn't mean you should stop.
They just try and get you to quit on yourself. It's like you said, they don't drop you because you're not moving it fast enough, as long as you're still going.
Yep, you have to keep making forward progress. You can't just sit there and wait the clock out. But it's, you know, there's not a graded go no go push up test at hour 46. I mean, right. it's after a certain point, like not only do they sort of flip the script a little bit and just make you prove that you want it, like internally, cadre are rooting for you. And I think honestly, at assessment, they started rooting for us pretty early on because they saw that. You know, it was going to be a long uphill battle for us and for both teams. But you can sort of tell that cadre knew what was coming up next, and they knew that we would have to do the wait to proceed. But they weren't being vicious in their statements of it. They would give you an honest assessment of, to do this, you have to do blank. You know, and if they would say like, you're stopping too much, that wasn't a taunt. That was a, if you keep stopping every 10 feet, or if you don't move at a certain distance, that means that you are going to be going at a pace that will not allow you to be successful in this event. So they had a sort of that mentality pretty early on of sort of telling you more or less what you had to do to stay in it. They couldn't do the work for you, but they would tell you straight up, you know, if I was going to tackle this, I would take some time right now to fix my apparatus. You have a long way to go. Take, you know, rather than it breaking down every couple of feet, be smarter about this because you can't be a meathead for the duration you still have to go. So be a little smart right now and then suck it up and deal with the horrible stuff. So it was just, thankfully, it was a different vibe than selection where they just want you to know at every turn that you are currently not meeting their internal standard.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was going with that. It appeared, at least from the live feed, that during team assessment, they were rooting for you and a little more openly rooting for you. During selection, they crack a lot of jokes, but they usually do that when the candidates are, you know, nowhere near to chuckle. But it seemed like they were, you know, making a couple jokes here and there while you guys were still in earshot. And then they were also, I mean, when you're doing the apparatus and you were pulling it, you know, they shined the light on where the other team was and kind of gave you a little intel there. It seemed like they were more, you know, rooting for you, trying to push you on than, like you said, just telling you awful truths about yourself.
Right.
So you felt that, it sounds like?
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely tell that, you know, it's at some points they clicked back over into their old ways and they were, you know, their crabby old mean selves. But for the most part, it was like, it wasn't their job to break us down. It was the job of the tasks. Like the entire event could have been a dry erase board that said, you will do this, and then you will do this, and then you will do this, and then you'll do this, and then you'll do this. There was no, like, with the exception of that horrible culvert, because I thought we were gaming off each other. With the exception of that, I genuinely believe that there was very, very little deviation from their initial plan. Like they probably had to tweak a few things for timing purposes, but in terms of, we are going to do a litter carry. After the litter carry, we're going to do an apparatus thing. After the apparatus, you're going to do 6 miles of rucking. In between each one, you have these set elements. Because they had all that gear laid out. So it wasn't like they were, you know, watching our behavior and then figuring out what the next element was going to be. It was all, you know, nicely sketched out and somebody's day planner ahead of time, and the work was in the work, and the teams that could get through the work were going to proceed, and the teams that couldn't weren't.
So was there anything that really surprised you or shocked you at team assessment, something that you weren't expecting, and when it came up, you're like, oh?
The total weight. Honestly, I was expecting it to be a slightly faster moving event. I was expecting a lot of 40 and 60 pound sandbags. So if you told me that like our 12 miler was going to be with a single 40 pound sandbag, that would have made a ton of sense. Like that was kind of where my head was at. It's going to be variations on the things that we've done before, or 2 40-pound sandbags. But the fact that we, you know, we were routinely under, you know, call it a 45 pound ruck. So when you put water in there, you're at 52 pounds, somewhere in that range, like water and food. And you get it wet, it's probably, you know, round up and call it 55 pounds. Like once you have a bag dunked in the water with all your gear, that plus, you know, 300 or 360 pound sandbags, or that plus 280s, that's a dumb amount of weight. So the total work capacity, I thought it was going to be a little more fast and heavy as opposed to slow and crushingly heavy. Beyond that, it was kind of expected. Like you saw the farm materials, you saw the apparatus stuff, you saw sort of all the fan favorites, but it was very, very low PT. Like I'd be surprised if we did 300, like outside the PT test, if we did 300 total reps of like PT, we did, you know, 25 or 38 pounds. We did, you know, 50 to 100 thrusters. You know, we did stuff, but we compare that against like selection, where it might be like a 6 hour welcome party of just sets of 10, sets of 10, sets of 10 on PT. We didn't do that. We got the, all right, here's your pile of stuff, go do a lap. You know, I haven't talked to Ragnar yet about getting like the final kind of breakdown, but it wouldn't surprise me if we did, you know, 30 miles around that field. And that's, you know, just shy of a 1 mile field. So that's just that on loop on loop on loop was special.
It's got to be a little taxing on the brain and the body.
Yeah. And thankfully, like everything was in pretty good shape. There was no like, you know, big muck spots. Like a couple of years has happened there. It's been just sloppy. And there was a little bit of a pond going on the base of the hill, but the bulk of the route was reasonably dry. Like we had pouring rain for the PT test, but by the time we left that park, everything had kind of mostly dried up and everything stayed reasonably okay for us for the rest. So it was just getting the miles in.
Yeah. And for those who are listening and haven't watched any of the live coverage or don't know what Jason's dad's property looks like, this wasn't, you know, a paved track. So it's not a, you know, 360 pounds or 280 pounds walking up and down the street. I mean, there's, you know, you paying attention where your feet are going. It's work.
Yeah, for sure. And they made it a point that on most laps, we would have to come back up to the house. So the way it's laid out is there's, you know, the house is at the top of a hill, and there's not a single photo that I've seen that does this hill justice, because it's longer than it looks and it's steeper than it looks. But it's, you know, it's not huge. It's like 100 meter ascent from the bottom of the hill to the top, which isn't too bad, but it's, you know, it's just that gets on you. It's just steep enough so you're always on your toes walking up there, so your calves get all blown out. So every lap we would go up and down the hill, we would go down the river, we would do the mile loop around this field and go right back up the hill. So it was not only, you know, it was a known distance. There's no surprises of like, ooh, maybe this will be a short lap. Like, no, it's going to be a lap. So you knew that like when you left the house, the heavy thing, you were doing some increment of a 1 mile loop for the most part. I think maybe 3 or 4 times we got cut across the middle of the field. So it got cut down to, you know, half mile or, you know, 0.4 mile type of thing. But for the most part, when you got a thing, you were doing that same loop. It's pretty easy to find like aerial photos, but it is a big field with a river on one side, a hill on one side, and then a tree line on the other two. So it's not scary terrain, but it's wooded and it's unsure footing, and the back of the route is always kind of soft, so you have to watch your step. So you can't, there's no place for you to really build up a head of steam on any part of it. It's a slug. Like it's a slug fest the whole way through.
Yeah. And every time I watch any live coverage where they're at Jason's dad's house, my ankles always just get a little tighter. Like, oh, it's going to be rough. One misstep.
Yeah. It is the type of thing where if you get too complacent, you can roll an ankle, and that's a silly way for your event to end. But it's a real way your event could end, of just, you turn your brain off for a little bit too long and, you know, you're done for a dumb misstep.
Absolutely. So did your team have any close calls, you know, speaking of missteps and that kind of stuff during this event? Or, you know, once you got going, once you got through PT and the event kicked off, did you guys, you know, pretty much know, as long as nothing too crazy happened, that you were finishing this?
Nothing in terms of like rolled ankles, but John's having a bit hard time being hydrated. And even when he was drinking water, he wasn't getting enough like salt into him, because we were doing fast turns. We were just doing, you know, for the most part, we were doing refit your bladder on water, take a second, drop your ruck, fix your feet for a second, get back out there. We weren't, and this is on us, but we weren't staying ahead of her. Okay, it feels like we've been doing this for 8 or 12 hours. I really need to, you know, ignore the fact that Cadre is kind of giving me a hard time to move faster. I need to stop and put some like ORS, some salts into my water, or things like that. Because I felt pretty okay, but I'm sure I was dehydrated. John was having a real tough go of it for a minute. And on the second day, there was a couple of hours that he was not super lucid. He was moving okay, but he wasn't making rational decisions. And I think if we didn't sort of fix that problem, he would have been pulled for medical reasons. And that would have sucked, but that would have been like the right call, because even though it wasn't super hot, because we had been, you know, pumping straight water the whole time, if you don't watch your salts, you can, you know, get hyponatremic. You can basically dilute your brain to the point where the chemicals don't work super well. And he was not doing super hot with that.
That's rough. And that just kind of goes back to the whole team versus team thing, right? Because if you're out there and you've lost, you know, the last one or last two, you saw them get breaks, you're like, you see them just a little bit ahead, you want to push yourself to get up and catch them and hopefully win this one, versus saying, I need to stop, you know, while we're on the clock and resalt so that I can keep going. I mean, it's a tough thing.
For sure. And somewhere like around the 20, 24 hour mark, like somewhere in that range, I kind of knew that we were no longer even in contention for racing for first. Like I knew that the culminating exercise was going to be a totally separate graded thing, but I could just like see how they were behaving and see how we were behaving. And I knew that it was the sort of scenario that we were racing for completion. We were not racing for being in a place to actually head to head race them at the end. It wasn't to be. So that's, I think right around then is when the tone of the event changed a bit for us, and we switched over to, all right, it's time to sit down for a second, because we're not going to get the time to go do it. So we have to kind of make our own time right now. And obviously Cadre would shuffle you on as quickly as possible, but we would sort of make that little gap happen for us, just because it wasn't a tenable situation. We weren't at a pace and at a trajectory that would have been sustainable for another 24 hours.
Yeah, that's always a tough decision to make, right? I mean, because you go, I don't know if you guys went out there with I'm sure you went out there with the idea of winning, because you know who you are. You've completed selection, and it's just kind of that mindset where if you sign up for something competitive, you go in with the goal of winning.
Yeah, or at least doing very well. So we definitely went out there with the goal of doing our damnedest. We weren't out there to get a participation award. We wanted to put some hurt on their teams out there, and it was for a myriad of reasons. It was not our day, so we kind of had to adapt plans and figure out what is the right way to take this from being a race that we're going to win to being an event that we're going to succeed at. So that kind of click over. On the second night, he was, you know, very non-lucid for a minute, but he was just asleep on his feet. So I just sat him down in the tree line for a second. And I changed on my base layer gear because I was getting hot, and I kind of let him turn his brain off for 2-3 minutes, and that helped for a while. And then we struggled on through until morning, and then sun came up, and everything was okay-ish.
Yeah. The way you're kind of wording this is it sounds like you I don't want to say failed at something, but, you know, didn't win. I mean, you still got second place, still silver medal, you know, top two. That's not bad.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, I'm not knocking the fact that we finished it. Like, every single person who signed up and didn't show up did notably worse at this event than we did. You know, they quit on themselves before they even tried. But on the same token, like, man, there was a game plan to go in and do super well, and it worked for a bit. And when it stopped working, we just had to come up with a new game plan. John and I never once, like, fought or raised our voice to each other. I think when the apparatus, like, the pieces on that final exercise, I kind of gave him, I'm just going to solve this real quick. You're more than welcome to take it over, but, like, one of us has to be the owner of this right now. Like, me and Miri, I don't care. That was about as tense as it got. Like, there wasn't a time other than that we didn't kind of just get into a rhythm and do our thing. So the fact that, you know, he finished the hardest event of his life, and I finished probably one of, like, the top 5 or 10 hardest races I've ever done, and nobody got hurt, and we got some fantastic barbecue out of the deal. I'm counting it as a win all around.
That sounds like a win. I mean, that barbecue, you can't beat that.
You cannot. They gave us a little bit of, like, pulled pork on that last morning before they kicked us out and sent us on our way in the final exercise. And that was a real, real eye opener. It changed my outlook on life for a couple hours.
So the way you're talking about this event, I mean, you're looking back on some parts and it sounds like it was really hard. Some parts, you kind of sound fond of them. It's noticeably different than when we were talking about selection the last time you were on, where, I mean, some parts were humorous, but nothing was, you know, really too fond. Is there a chance that you would do team assessment again?
There's a better chance that I would do team assessment again than I would do selection again. I would need a real good why for it. But I mean, it's not the type of thing that I would do every year. But if a friend of mine had, like, a real hard time and needed the event sort of, you know, yes, you know, he'd had therapy more or less, I wouldn't say no to it. Also, I mean, who knows what HQ is actually doing with it? They've already made sort of a statement that the event will be run exactly as it was this year. So 45 pounds dry that anybody can do. And they've added up, you know, they're calling it a women's division right now, but I don't know what that entails. I mean, if they did something where it was anybody can do the full event, you know, quote unquote full event with a 45 pound ruck, or you can go in there with a 30 or a 20 pounds, like 30 for guys, 20 for ladies, and treat it as more of, I don't know, like a fun run almost. I would do that type of thing again. I don't know if I would actively sign up for the weights that I saw on this, like the 45 pound ruck and 360 pound sandbags is a lot of weight. But if they decide to do a, I don't know, I don't want to call it team assessment light, but there's no better term for it, like a team assessment light that is more open and approachable to let people figure out, like, I think I can, I've done a heavy, I think I can also do a 48 hour event that is not selection, but it's not nothing. Really, I enjoy, you know, that 36 plus hour event because it's, you know, 2 days is a long time.
Yeah, 2 days is a long time for an event. And I think I really was excited when, you know, Gorok started bringing out this competitive nature. And I mean, we both watched parts of the Rogue Invitational last weekend, where Gorek had the opening workout or event or whatever you want to call it. And I mean, that was fun to watch. I had a really good time watching those teams compete and the individuals compete. And so it almost makes you wonder if there's, you know, room in the Gorek arsenal for more competitive natured events.
I don't know. I mean, if there was a competitive class or like a competitive class for basically a scaled division, I would give that serious thought, because it's not the time kind of constraint that concerns me. It's just, man, that's a lot of time under a lot of weight, under a lot of pack. I would sign up for something that was a little more competitive, but more fun, and I would sign up for that beating again, because that sucked.
What was your least favorite part of the event? Was there anything that just stuck out to you and was like, that was, like you said, you know, that sucked? Was there anything that sucked the worst?
Yeah, I mean, when the litter fell apart on us, that was definitely garbage. The first lap we did with the litter carry, the 180-pound litter carry, I think the Padres sort of planned that out. They might have done the mental math based off of coherent people who hadn't just done 24 hours of work, because the total work on that was real nasty. That took us hours to get through that first lap, and I don't think they were planning on it taking quite as long as it did.
Yeah, I can see that. That's one of those things, right, where it gets tough to calculate how people will degrade over time. I mean, because they might have been planning, like you said. I mean, from the videos, they had all those sandbags there at the beginning. They were planning for a lot of teams. Some more teams would have breaks. And so you'd probably only have, you know, one or two smoked teams, and then two that are coming in a little bit fresher because they've had a couple of seconds. But what they got was, you know, one team that got some breaks and one team that kind of came in a little smoked. So it just gets tough to factor that in.
Yeah, even Team 5, like, they were ahead of us going into that, but like they were riding the struggle bus on that litter carry too. That was just a lot of load to move for a long distance. And I think that the fact that we got I think they called it a field amputation, where they cut it from 180 to 120 for the litter carry on miles 2 and 3, like that was very much the right call, because could we have finished? So yeah, we both teams could have finished going forward with that weight, but man, it would have eaten up hours and hours and hours. It wouldn't have surprised me if the laps after that would have taken, you know, 20-30% longer on each iteration, and that's just no fun for anybody to watch.
Because you're not going to end up going faster. I mean, you're only degrading.
Yeah, I was going to say, the chances of me like hitting my stride and getting better at that litter carry after the first, like, you know, 3 hours of doing it, I would bet against an improvement over time, and just assume that things are always going to get a little bit worse until it ends.
It's probably a safe bet to make. So is there anything about team assessment, either comparing it to selection or just the event in itself in its own right, that, I mean, we might not have talked about that we should be talking about, or that you want to talk about? Because, I mean, obviously you were there, you participated and you finished, and I watched some of the live coverage, so I don't know everything that went on there.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think now that it's happened and people have sort of seen it, everyone knows that, like, it's not, like, initially there was, like, people were calling it team selection, and it's not that. Like, it's hard, it's terrible, it's really pretty grueling, but it's not really comparable to even the vibe of selection, let alone the types of work you're doing. So for people who are on the fence about signing up for next year, like, I don't know, go do it. Go do the hard thing, because it's definitely going to be the hard thing that you do that year. In the world of people that do like the Gorek stuff, I'd say there's maybe a dozen folks who will do a race harder than that next year. Everybody else who wants to go do team assessment, it's probably going to be the most unpleasant thing you encounter that year, and that's cool, because it should be bad and it should be hard. But it's also entirely doable. I mean, it's constant forward progress will eventually get you across the finish line. You just have to train with your partner, and you have to want it enough, and you have to have a good reason why you're going to stay in it until it's done. But the, you know, the sort of the initial mystery has been taken away because we've now seen what it looks like. So train for an event like that and find somebody who you're okay falling apart with and sign up for it.
That's great advice. And I mean, it does seem like a really hard event, but I like that you said it was doable. And so the two final questions I've got here, the first is, your partner and you go to the same gym, so you trained a lot together. Did you notice that training together with your partner helped out? Or do you think that having a partner that you meet, you know, in a Facebook group or online, that's a possibility there as well?
Oh, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, if you're open and honest and you communicate with your teammate, you could do this with minimal face-to-face contact. I mean, you would have to coordinate like crazy offline, and you would have to have sort of very open discussions with them, you know, over email or over Facebook to sort of figure out like, hey man, just so you know, like, I get real crabby when I haven't eaten in a while. So when I start like getting sleepy, it's not you, it's my hanger monster. Those are things that are definitely easier if you've trained with the person theoretically with in person. But I mean, it's not impossible. I mean, I've done a couple events now that are, you know, 30 plus hours long with somebody who I've only met online. Like I did a race 2 years ago and we won it and we had never ever raced together and we spoke very minimally ahead of time. So it's not impossible to get into a groove, but if you have the ability to train up with somebody, like, man, take it. There's so many little things that you can cue off each other. There's so many little nuances that if you know how that person behaves under certain stressors, or if you know that, you know, if you know how to push them, if you know when not to push them, like those little things, they're super nice to be able to lean on them when you know they're stronger than you, and also like have to gently take away some of the load when you know they're hurting on a certain thing.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people are seeing that with the Star Course, you know, training up for a 50 miler, training in person versus, you know, doing remote training with someone. It's just nice to know, you know, the person that you're out there with, know how they tick and what you can do to support them, you know, because some people, when you get into those longer distances, longer times, you know, what they need is tough love, and sometimes they don't. And just knowing what you can do to get them back right again is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people need to be motivated by you just leaving them alone and letting them feel pooped for a minute, and then they'll go off and be back and fine and do it. Other people need that little bit of a, you know, oomph to keep going.
Absolutely. And then the final question I have is just, it kind of goes back to dumping gear. I mean, you guys played it smart, but did you practice dumping your rucks and packing them for this event?
Yeah, not a ton, but I mean, I teach a class at my gym for like this really dedicated toward endurance stuff. So we do mostly dumb meathead things, but we also do a good deal of skill work. So there's plenty of like, hey, how do you tie basic knots? How do you make runners work for you? How do you, you know, how do you carry a sandbag in an awkward spot? And one of the things we do is we'll do, you know, especially in the winter when it's stupid dark outside, we'll do gear dumps, or we'll, you know, we'll do a little bit of that stuff. So it's something I've done, you know, a couple dozen times over the years, but it's not like we had a stopwatch and speed ran it. But it's more about being super comfortable about, like, if you don't know every piece of gear that's in your ruck, you're in a bad spot. So you need to know like what it is, roughly where it is, what it's used for, what it can be used for in a pinch, and then, you know, sort of how to work with it. Like, you know, I'm a huge proponent of the thin nylon runners. If you don't know how to use them, they're useless. So it's, if you don't get a piece of gear because somebody else put it to, get a piece of gear because you at least explored it enough to know that it works well for you. And that should be your ruck as well. Like I had a 40 liter GR2, which is a monstrous thing, but I knew I would rather have a little bit of space in there and a little bit of like, you know, room to put pockets and such to keep things organized and out of the way. And that was more important to me than having a high and tight ruck the whole time.
Yeah. And all that stuff can be figured out through practice. You know, when you put that GO2 on, that wasn't the first time you'd put it on. I bet you had trained with it. And, you know, just like the nylon runners, if you're buying stuff because it's on a packing list somewhere and throwing it in your ruck, I mean, it's like the person who shows up with the first aid kit and then something happens and they, you know, they open it. It's been pressurized. They're like, all right, do you have this? And like, well, this is the first time I've ever seen this stuff before.
Right.
It doesn't help out too much. So that's all awesome, awesome advice.
Yep. Yeah. Don't let any of your gear be a surprise to you. There's enough unknowns at the event. The stuff you're bringing to the event should not be foreign to you in any way, shape, or form.
There will be enough foreign objects there for you to carry and, exactly, and deal with.
Yeah. If you feel like you need more strange things, ask Cadre. They'll happily give you more strange things.
Absolutely. Well, James, thank you so much again. I mean, for taking all this time. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm glad we're able to find some time to chat. And this has been a ton of fun.
For sure. Anytime.
Thank you so much for listening to the All Day Ruck Off podcast. This has been episode number 102. James, I want to thank you so much again for being on. I truly appreciate you taking the time, man. And it was so fun to talk with you about team assessment and tying it back to the differences with selection. If you want links to anything we talked about in this episode, you can head on over to the show notes, alldayruckoff.com/podcast/episode-102. And I really hope you enjoyed this interview. Only 6 teams showed up, only 2 finished. And I think after this live coverage, there'll be more next year. I think it'd be a ton of fun to see with a lot of teams there. I think James has some really awesome points, and I'm just excited to see where this event goes. If you want to support the All Day Ruck Off podcast, there's a couple ways to do that. For free, you can leave a review on either Apple Podcasts or on our Facebook page. Those are all truly appreciated, and I really enjoy reading those. The other options, if you want to support it financially, you can pick stuff up from the All Day Ruck Off store at alldayruckoff.com/store. A lot of rucking gear and other rucking related goods there. I think we just passed 100 items in the shop, so it's a lot of stuff. Finally, if you want to support through Patreon, you can head on over to patreon.com/alldayruckoff, and there's some bonus content there for supporting through that. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for all of the incredible support. Thank you for being an awesome member of this community. And as always, don't forget, attitude is everything. Keep yours positive and drink hard, ruck harder.